It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan.
Welcome back to Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori. And there is a film that opened in New York recently and is being distributed nationally this week called Phantom of the Open. If you'd like to watch a fun, joyful, and very moving, feel-good film based on a true story, I recommend you see Phantom of the Open. The film is based on a true story about a former crane operator from Northern England who registered to play in the local qualifier for the Open Championship. The problem was he never played golf before. 46-year-old Maurice Flitcroft was his name. And back in the 70s, he picked up a set of clubs, taught himself to play on a nearby beach. He registered to play in a local Open Championship qualifier as a professional and got in. No one checked his credentials. When registering, his wife checked that he was a professional, probably because she didn't know any better. He ended up shooting a 121 for 18 holes, the worst score ever. But he became a folk hero through the years, billed as the worst golfer ever. And he continued to crash several other Open qualifiers, playing in disguises and under different names. And Simon Farnaby, who co-wrote the book Phantom of the Open and adapted it to the screenplay, Simon joins us now. Simon Farnaby is an actor, comedian, writer. Welcome to Talking Golf, Simon. How you doing?
I'm very well, and thank you for having me. And thanks for that lovely introduction and very, very eloquent pre-say of what the film's all about. Thank you.
My pleasure. Well, you know, I watched the film the other night, and I must say it's, as I said, it's a feel-good, joyous, moving story in these challenging times of ours, right? It's so heartwarming. So well done, Simon. How did you connect to this story?
Well, I grew up around golf. My dad was a greenkeeper at a club in the northeast of England. And I heard about Maurice when I was a junior, this guy who couldn't play golf, who'd entered the Open. And a lot of the other juniors and myself really connected to him because all the senior members hated him. And when you're a junior at my club, the juniors and the women, this is in the 80s, early 80s, just you felt like second-class citizens, like the men owned the whole place and they were of a particular social strata. So we sort of loved the sound of Maurice. And then, to be honest, I forgot about him. I played golf. I nearly turned professional when I was 16, but I wasn't quite good enough to be, you know, in the Open or the US Masters or whatever. So I went into comedy and writing. And then in 2007, Maurice Flitcroft died. And I read all about him in the obituaries in the newspapers. I didn't realize how big he was, actually. He was in all the broadsheet newspapers. And I just read about him and went, oh, it's that guy. It's that guy I remember from when I was a junior. And the more I read about him, the more intrigued I got. And I thought this could really marry my old sort of passion for golf and my new passion for writing and films. And it was the perfect sort of synergy of the two. So I did a hell of a lot more research, and that's how we got the book and then the movie.
Well, I know the film has several important themes using golf as a vehicle for several meaningful messages. One of the messages is about dreaming and risk-taking. And Flitcroft, he was obviously a dreamer. He was not deterred by how bad of a golfer he was, the embarrassment of shooting high scores, being totally out of his league, being banned by the RNA. I mean, he wasn't deterred by any of that.
No, it's amazing. And actually, I didn't know where that came from in his personality until I was researching for the book, and we found it was like a real golden moment. We went to visit Maurice's sons, the twins who were in the film, who actually became world disco dancing champions. Great, great characters. And I said to them, have you got anything of your dad's, like any diaries or letters? And they went, no. And then about a day later, they said, oh, we do. We've got his unpublished autobiography. And he'd written a 500-page, handwritten autobiography, never been published, never even been seen by a publisher. And And when we got hold of that, that was the gold mine. And that really detailed everything that he was thinking about. And really where it came from was, he was from a very working class background. This is the key to the whole thing. And where he was from, you either worked in the shipyard or you didn't work. So very working class. I don't know what the equivalent in America would be, but he was a docker, you know, like the docks. But when he was about 8 years old, during the war, he was evacuated to Scotland to a middle-class family. And in that middle-class family, they said, oh, you can be anything you want to be. Don't be tied down by where you're from, you know. And he took that philosophy. He was the only one that didn't want the war to end. He went back home and they said, you're going to work in the shipyard? And he went, no, I'm going to follow my dreams. And I'm going to be like, you know, do whatever I want to do. But sadly, where he was from, all he could do was a shipyard. So when he was 46 and he discovered golf, he went, this is it. This is my dream, my calling. He went for it and just never stopped. Even when he was 76, he said, I think I've got one more shot at the Open left in me.
Unbelievable that you got your hands on that autobiography, Simon. Was it ever published?
No, but what we did was so Morris, his unpublished autobiography was called The Phantom of the Open. And so me and Scott Murray, who wrote the book, in tribute to Morris, we called our book The Phantom of the Open. And we have lots of quotes and excerpts from that unpublished autobiography in the book. And actually, a lot of that made it into the movie. Like, a lot of the things you see in the movie are things he actually said, you know, all the letters to the RNA and his fight with the RNA is all word for word what's in the movie. The speech he makes in America towards the end, I don't want to give anything away, but that's verbatim what he said, you know, in that moment. So a lot of it, people say how much of it is true. And as I say, it's all of it, you know, it's really, really, really as accurate as we could be. So that was a great moment finding that autobiography.
Unbelievable. You made Flitcroft out to be the most innocent, naive, optimistic, lovely guy. And based on what you're saying, he really was like that in real life.
Yeah, I mean, I think when he first discovered golf, you know, golf's a game you can play on your own. I always see it like you have Pop Idol in the States or American Idol, I think it's called. Like, and singing, you know, I compare it to that. Like, he was in the equivalent of being in his room on his own, but he was on the beach practicing golf and he was thinking, I can do this. You know, this seems like I'm hitting shots like they're as good as I see on the TV. So he genuinely thought he was good enough. Now, after he shot 121 and became famous for being bad, he realized he wasn't as good as he thought he was. But because the RNA, I think you mentioned earlier, banned him from even joining a club, and he'd already fallen in love with the game of golf, he had no choice but to keep coming back to the Open because that's the only place he could get a game.
Well, yeah, one of the messages of the film is, you know, to overcome failure, just keep trying, pick yourself up, be persistent, keep going. And those messages are so key. I just thought that was beautiful of him to keep trying, even though, as you say, the opportunities were getting less and less. And then another message really is about love. He seemed to do everything for his wife and family, and he was totally devoted to them.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Jean, his wife, it's a strange character because the more we dug into Jean, the more I sort of went, at first I was going, did she support him? And then she wavered or she didn't believe in him. But the truth was that she supported him and believed in him the whole way. You know, Jean actually had children out of wedlock, but she was, which is hard for people to imagine, but she was sort of disgraced at that time in the 50s. And Morris didn't care about that. Morris said, I love you. I'll take your child, on, you know, as if it's my child, and I don't care what people say. And for that, she just sort of really supported him through whatever he wanted to do, you know, and she was his rock. And as well, his sons, you know, Gene and James and Mike, his stepson, you know, came to support him and what he was doing. And I mean, Mike in the movie represents a lot of Morris's, some of Morris's family who didn't appreciate what he was doing, because obviously he became famous, or infamous, if you like, and some members of his family really didn't like that and thought he was a disgrace, but have since come around to sort of saying, you know, being very supportive of the film and saying, thank you for putting this, you know, his name up in lights, if you like.
That's right. And Gene, his wife, the character Gene, was played so beautifully by Sally Hawkins, the Academy Award nominee. In 1988, Blithfield Country Club in Grand Rapids, Michigan, flew Flitcroft and his family in for a member guest that they named after him, in which you're awarded for being the worst golfer.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, this was a big thing, you know, that wasn't actually in the press, you know. And when I was researching for the movie, I was thinking, what's my ending, and how's this going to come right for Morris? And that, and then we found out about this tournament in Blithfield, Michigan, run by a wonderful guy called Terry Moore, who's still alive and is a big supporter of the film. And Terry just fell in love with Morris and Morris's story and set up this competition, which was a family day, you know, which was a day where members could bring their family who maybe didn't play golf, and the worst score wins. And they had all sorts of things, like they had two holes on each green. And so it celebrated bad golf, which, let's face it, is what most of us play. And that was just great. And they flew him over for the 10-year anniversary. I think it was in 86, or you might be right, maybe it was 88. And Morris loved that. That was the highlight of his life, because he'd never been abroad before. He never even had a passport. He even kept the first class, the menu for the first class ticket. You know, he kept it. Sure. He was so proud of it.
Yeah, no, it's just a great story. Now, you know, we were talking about messages earlier, and that it also shines a light on golf and the whole environment and the private club life and the snootiness that sometimes exists amongst, you know, that private golf club environment, right? As you had mentioned earlier.
Oh, yeah. I mean, golf's a little better now. I don't know what it's like in the States, but in the UK, it's much better in terms of it's more inclusive. But back then, it was very much, you know, you had to have a lot of money to play. And you were looked down upon if you were from the wrong sort of class. But Morris Morris didn't know about any of that when he found golf. He thought it was like football, or, you know, just a sport for everyone. And he couldn't understand why he wasn't welcome. And he used to say, you know, golf should be like, we have a thing called the FA Cup in the UK, which is where all the little teams can enter this competition. And sometimes they make it really far, you know, they make it to the quarterfinals or even semifinals. And golf, and Morris is like, this should be what golf's like anyone can have a go. And actually, his attitude to the game, the late, great Peter Alice, I don't know if you know him over there.
Sure,
he was a big, big, huge commentator and the voice of golf. And he actually played with Morris in the 80s. He played nine holes with him and did an article for Golf Monthly. And he said, I wish that half the pros that I meet these days had the same amount of passion and of the fun of golf and sure. enjoyed golf like Morris did. He said his etiquette was perfect. His manners were incredible. And he said he couldn't play, he was useless, but at least he was, but I tell you what, his passion and his love of the game was second to none. He said it was the best he'd ever seen.
And that's and what really, you the, celebrate in the film.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, it was cast beautifully. Mark Rylance plays Flitcroft, the Academy Award winner, Best Supporting Actor, Bridge of Spies. He plays him to perfection in terms of his blind optimism, his naivete, his never say die spirit. Don't you think? I mean, it was just a perfect role for Mark Rylance.
Yeah. I mean, we actually, when I wrote the screenplay, all I had was Morris's voice and image in my head, because there's footage of him. There's quite a lot, actually, especially from America, that the footage is in the film. It's worth seeing it. If you go and see it, stay right to the end and you'll see the real footage. So I didn't actually know who my dream casting was. I hadn't even thought about it. And then Craig Roberts, the director, said, "What about Mark Rylance?" And I was bowled over. I went, "Perfect. If he'll do it." Mark has a quiet dignity, and no matter what he's doing, and that's what he brought to Morris. Like, he's doing something utterly ridiculous. What most people would say, "Why the hell is this guy? He can't play. What's he doing here?" But Mark, conducted himself with dignity. I don't know what he does. He has a clown. He has a clown in the old sense. He's a clown in, like, he's very, you can read what he's thinking, you know, and he's, how lucky were we? He's a brilliant actor. When we sent the script to Mark, he loved it. He totally got it. Immersed himself in the character, went to visit the families. The Morris's family love Mark. Like, every screening we go to and the family are there, they say, "Where's Mark? Is he here?" They adore him. So he did him proud.
Well, it must have been very challenging to make this story, outrageous story, seem real, but it's so based on a true story. So would you say that was your biggest challenge in writing the screenplay?
Yes, I think that's a good point. I mean, it's weird. In the UK, people say, "I wish I'd known how true this was." Because right at the end of the film, you see a lot of footage which lets you know how true it was. And it is quite difficult to believe it. But actually, it was quite easy in a way for me. Like, I've written films, like I wrote, co-wrote Paddington 2, for example, which is obviously not based on a true story. But it's sort of easier in a way. When you've got a true story, you have to immerse yourself in it. And then you basically curate the moments of the true story to make it into a nice narrative. And actually, most of the time, it was saying, "We don't need that. That's not true. That didn't happen. We don't need that." And stick to what actually happened. And Mark was big in that. Mark Rylance kept saying, "I don't think I should do this because it didn't really happen," because Mark knew everything about Morris. And so we just stuck with that, you know. And it's funny, like, in the UK, there was a couple of, for example, there was a review that loved the film that said, "I'm not sure about the speech at the end. It was a bit sugary for me." And I went, "Well, that's exactly what you said. There's nothing I can do about that, because that's his words, word for word." So it's quite interesting in that respect. You know, sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction.
That's true. Well, we'll end on that note. Good luck with the film Phantom of the Open, heartwarming, funny, moving, and joyously captivating. Simon Farnaby, the guy who wrote the screenplay, thanks so much for joining us on Talking Golf.
Thanks, Alan. I hope your listeners enjoy it as much as you did. Fabulous. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
It's Talking Golf with Anne Liguori on The Fan.
All righty. Well, welcome back to Talking Golf with Anne Liguori. Glad you can join us this morning. And Mark Canizzaro of the New York Post joins us as well. Good morning, Mark. Welcome to Talking Golf.
Good morning, Anne. How are you doing today?
Hey, great to see you, by the way. Tuesday, congratulations on your journalism award and to all the winners at the Met Golf Writers National Awards dinner. That was some night.
Including yourself, Anne. Let's not just leave that out now, right?
Listen,
congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. I was so honored. And let's just say it was good that Hank Gola kept his introduction of you under, what, 10 minutes?
He had like a 7-page written speech. So I don't know how. I wasn't timing it, but it didn't seem like it went that quickly.
Anyway, it was a great evening. And I congratulated all the winners earlier in the show. But I want to dive right into, we want to get to the Travelers Championship in a second. But last week, PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan announced changes that he and the team will implement to the PGA Tour schedule in an effort to enhance the tour to its membership and, you know, prevent more guys from jumping ship, basically, to live golf. And you wrote earlier this week, Mark, that it is too little too late, right?
I did. And the premise of that, Anne, was was kind of off of a story I'd written back in February, speaking to a couple of players about the fact that they had gone to Jay in the fall and made a proposal to have an 8-series team type event, kind of, you know, a knockoff of what the Saudis are doing, and blended into the PGA Tour schedule. But the catch was that it was going to be player and investor owned, those eight events. And the tour, which wants to control everything, obviously, said no, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And kind of the premise of what I wrote was, you know, well, here we are now, because that would have absolutely, you know, cut the Saudi, you know, the Greg Norman Saudi League off at the knees, really, at that point, because they would have had, you know, no concept to sell. And, you know, at the end of the day, Jay and the tour did not take it seriously enough. They didn't think, you know, I quoted somebody that said that Jay had told them that he didn't think the Saudi thing was ever going to get off the ground. And, you know, here we are, you know, months later, and now they're a true threat.
It sounds like that proposal, as you say, that they pitched in the fall, it sounded very similar to what LIV Golf is now.
Oh, it totally is. It was pretty much a very similar model. But the point was that, you know, the tour would have this, you know, this would be, even though it wasn't tour owned and controlled, it would be, you know, players and investors, you know, all kind of in business with the tour, so to speak, with this concept. So it's a complicated thing, but the bottom line is it should have been taken much more seriously by Jay and the tour, and it wasn't. And now they find themselves really on the back foot, you know, very kind of playing defense right now, which is what's happening. When the announcement on Wednesday was all about raising the purses and all that kind of thing. And, you know, what's that in a response to? You know, it's in a response to what LIV is doing, which is drawing a lot of the stars away from the PGA Tour. And that's really the shame of this whole thing, is that it's dividing the game and, you know, taking some of the stars away from these events, you know, where people want to see the best playing against the best. And if Bryson and DeChambeau and, you know, Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson are playing at LIV and they're suspended by the PGA Tour, they're not competing against, you know, the guys who are on the tour, like the Rorys and Justin Thomases and whatnot. And that's where the fans are losing.
And Monahan had said this past week, this is an arms race. The only weapons here are dollar bills. The PGA Tour can't compete with a foreign monarchy that is spending billions of dollars in an attempt to buy the game of golf. I mean, obviously, it's Saudi-funded, this LIV Golf, and they have unlimited amounts of money. So, really, what can the PGA Tour do? I mean, they just have so much money. What can they do to fight back?
That's a good question. You know, what they can't fight it. They can't fight back financially. So the question then becomes: these players are all suspended by the tour. You know, if and when, and I think we all expect the word to be when, really, those players take the tour to court, does the PGA Tour have the right to suspend these guys and prevent them from playing PGA Tour events? Because they're independent contractors, as we both know. And, you know, I did a story about 2 weeks ago in the Post, speaking to some lawyers who specialize in non-compete and whatnot, and really, unanimously didn't think the PGA Tour would win in court. So, you know, that's where this is headed, unfortunately. And as sports fans, we don't want to hear stuff about what's going on in the courts, right? I mean, that's kind of, you know, that doesn't draw eyeballs to the game. So that's kind of where this is headed. But in terms of what the PGA Tour can do, I'm not sure. You know, right now, you know, I can tell you for a fact from speaking to some players that their players have been disappointed and put off by the way Jay has handled this. A lot of them have. And, you know, part of their disappointment was how kind of passive he's been. I don't know if you saw, you know, his interview in the with Jim Nantz on the Sunday of the Canadian Open, the RBC Canadian, the week before the U.S. Open. I mean, I just felt like Jay, you and I may have talked about this off the air. he just seemed not sure of himself and didn't sound like a strong leader. And that was alarming to some of the players. And I think that was a little bit of what we saw on Wednesday, him kind of a tough talk, was a bit of a response to that, and kind of a fighting back vibe that we got out of him. So,
right.
I don't know where this is going to go in terms of, you know, the future, but I can tell you this, as you referred, to the question, the Saudis have so much money, it seems to be bottomless, so they're not going away anytime soon.
Now, if world ranking points aren't offered to LIV Golf, how do you think that's going to affect, a lot of these players eventually trying to get into these major championships?
That is really that's the $64,000 question. You have players like Phil, Koepka, DJ, who are past champions. In Phil and DJ's case, the Masters and U.S. Open, not the U.S. Open, but, Koepka, former U.S. Open. So these guys are exempt already to get in. But the other guys, it could be an issue because world ranking points for our listeners are one of the primary ways that the players get into these major championships, how they qualify. And, I think this is what Monahan is hoping is going to happen, that the world rankings will not give ranking points to the LIV Tour. And the other thing here to me that's the real life jacket for Monahan is what the majors do, what Augusta does. We saw this week the European Tour, the DP World Tour, which is called now, not allow players, the LIV players, to play in the Scottish Open. But that's a little bit short-ended because they haven't come out and said that they can't play any European Tour events or DP Tour events. So, because that Scottish Open is also co-sanctioned by the PGA Tour. So what Monahan needs is strength in numbers, most notably the majors. So if Augusta National, which frankly controls almost everything in the sport because it's so powerful, if they come out and basically say all the LIV players can't play in their tournament, that's a big feather in Jay's cap. But if you notice, the majors have been very quiet on this, and there's a reason for this. If the majors start jumping in and say, yeah, we're going to do what the PGA Tour is doing, then you have the aspect of collusion in play. Mm. So everybody's very, very careful about that. And I think that's why, that's why everybody's been kind of coyly silent here, so to speak.
Interesting. It's collusion, free agency. It all sounds very familiar.
We want to talk about birdies and bogeys, don't we? Not courts collusion.
But with all these other organizations who handle the other majors allowing the LIV Golf players in, I can't imagine Augusta National not allowing them and doing something completely different. Although they're certainly a different entity.
They are. What they could do, Ann, and I've heard some whispers, they could alter their invitation process, because at the end of the day, the Masters is an invitational, so to speak. So they could alter that a little bit. There's so much to be played out here yet, and there's so many layers to this story. It's going to be going on for a long time. I mean, it really is, because this is nothing's cut and dried here.
What are your thoughts about Brooks Koepka? He was chastising the media at the U.S. Open for asking questions about LIV Golf, and then you just knew based on how he was dealing with it that he was going to bolt. Very hypocritical on Brooks' part, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, what Brooks and DJ and Bryson were all kind of I put them all in the same boat. Basically, they all came out publicly and pretty much said they weren't going and they were denouncing it. And they were pledging their allegiance to the PGA Tour, mostly DJ and Bryson. And then they turn around and Rory has been so good talking about this too, by the way, who's been really the most, honest and kind of level-headed voice to all of this. Rory is just like, you can't believe what anybody says anymore because everybody says one thing and does another, and that's what's been happening. And so for these three guys, particularly Brooks, most recently, they're just sabotaging their credibility, But at the end of the day, I did a column the other day with speaking to Xander Schauffele on Thursday, the day after you and I saw. I think it was the day we saw each other actually on Thursday.
That's right.
So, um, and um, you know, I did a story with him, and he was very, very, very honest in saying, when I talked to him about Liv, in saying, listen, I don't want to say no, because everybody has their number. You know, everybody has his or her number. And, you know, he said, I don't know what my number is, but, you know, he didn't want to be one of those guys saying, no, I'm never going to go, because then he's going to look like the other guys and be disingenuous. And so he was very, very open in saying that. He said, I have to speak in generalities, because you never know. If somebody comes to me with some wild offer, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know?
Wow.
And that's, you know, and so everybody has their number.
Do you think he would jump? You know, it just seemed like somebody like that wouldn't. And by the way, Xander Schauffele has that one-shot lead over his good buddy Patrick Cantlay heading into the Travelers Championship final round today. But somebody like Xander, I just can't imagine him doing that. But as you say, the money that they're offering is so tempting that even people that you think, you know, would never do it, who believe in legacy and history and the competition that the PGA Tour offers, you're thinking some of these guys may go.
I do. And you know, at the end of the day, and I think what people really want, what these players want, they want to be able to do both. You know, they want their cake and eat it too, so to speak. And I find no problem with that, to be honest with you. I mean, I feel like maybe it's Pollyanna to say, but I feel like they should be able to do, they're independent contractors that should be able to do both. Make your money, you know, with your big appearance fee stuff with Liv and still be on the PGA Tour. And I think that's, at the end of the day, that's what the way it's going to end up is the way I see it in some manner. I'm not sure exactly how, but so I think that's what we're going to end up seeing. And that's what these players are kind of banking on. That's also what the Liv people and their lawyers are telling these players that go over. They say, listen, you're going to be able to do both. Like, they're kind of selling it on that, you know? So it's, you know, listen, nobody has an answer. Nobody really knows until a court of law rules, right? But that's kind of what they've been sold.
So your thoughts about the final round at the Travelers Championship, what do you, I mean, Xander's playing great. Patrick Cantlay shooting, he went low yesterday. He started a 63. I love seeing these low numbers after the U.S. Open. It's so refreshing. These guys are relaxed. They're playing great golf. The fans love all the birdies. What are your thoughts about the final round of the Travelers?
Well, you know, Rory said on Thursday to us after he shot 62, he had the greatest line of the week, really. He said, you know, coming to the Travelers after grinding it out at the U.S. Open is like U.S. Open rehab. That's the way he called it, you know? I love the way, you know, that he stated that. But, you know, I think what's cool for about today, and it's weird, Travelers, they get a terrific field every year, as you know, Ann, and they do such a good job at this tournament. It's hugely popular because, you know, Connecticut, you know, where I'm a native, you know, from where I'm a native, does not have a professional sports franchise. You know, we used to have the Whalers back in the day in Hartford, but, you know, that's long gone. So, In a sense, this Travelers Championship is kind of Connecticut's pro franchise, and they treat it as such. I mean, the fans come out to this event, and it's cool to see. And frankly, they've had some really good finishes over the years here. Last year, an 8-hole playoff with Harris English ended up winning. But we're kind of set up for something maybe like that today, when you think about it, because you got Cantlay. You know, Cantlay is just one shot back of Xander. And here's the cool thing element to that, kind of the sidebar to that, is these guys are not only really good friends, and their significant others are really tight. They're teammates. They just won that Zurich Classic,
right,
which is the team event in New Orleans, and they've been Ryder Cup and President's Cup teammates. So they're going to be now dueling it out in the final pairing this afternoon, which is going to be pretty cool. Yeah, they both talked about it afterwards yesterday, saying it's a comfortable pairing, and it's kind of cool that they get a chance to go at each other in the final round of an actual tournament rather than being in the same pairing together. So, and listen, there's plenty of other guys in the mix here as well, obviously, just behind them. I mean, Kisner, you know, made a run yesterday. There's a handful of people up there. Sigala had
anything can
day.
Happen, Mark.
Yeah, but
listen,
I think we're out of time.
I have to say thank you. I really appreciate your insight. Enjoy the final round of the Travelers Championship, and once again, congratulations on on the Journalism Award, and appreciate you coming on. Mark Canizero, my thanks to Mark, my thanks to Simon Farnaby, to Ed, our Zooming in the studio. Talking Golf with Ann LaGoria is brought to you by Travelers. It's better under the umbrella. Stay tuned for Rick Wolf and the Sports Edge, and I'll talk to you next Sunday morning right here on Talking Golf with Ann LaGoria.